From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Congressional Budget Office released a report on Monday concluding that the 35-day government shutdown cost taxpayers a total of $11 billion. According to the report, in CBO's estimation, the shutdown dampened economic activity, mainly because of the loss of furloughed federal workers' contribution to GDP. Of the $11 billion loss, $3 billion will never be recovered. Meanwhile, government agencies impacted by the record-breaking shutdown are struggling to recover and resume operations. Furloughed workers that have missed two paychecks are likely to begin receiving back pay by the middle of next week. But federal contractors, including low-paid workers like janitors and food service workers and security guards, are not guaranteed back pay. It may be months or even years before all the impacts of the shutdown are undone. What lessons can progressives take from a battle that was largely fought in the legislative arena, but where the power and the plight of workers and organized labor played a role? My guest is Arun Gupta. He's an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Raw Story. He's also a contributor to The Intercept. And he's the author of the forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, and regular news correspondent on our program. Welcome back, Arun.
Thanks for having me on.
So before we get to who, what lessons there are for progressives, let's also talk about who won the shutdown, if you will. And I'm sort of loath to discuss that because it makes it sound like this game, but in a way it was a chess game in the way in which Democrats and Republicans and Trump fought it. The consensus seems to be that Pelosi emerged the winner.
Yeah, I think that's very true. You know, just a couple of months ago, it looked like it was going to be unlikely that she would even be elected by her caucus as a Speaker of the House. There was a lot of dissent against her. Republicans had effectively used her in the midterm elections, running ads against her. And I think a couple of dozen Democrats said that they would not support her for Speaker. And so she very much kept the caucus unified. Towards the end, there were about 30 lawmakers who started to get Democrats whose spine started to weaken, and they were calling on Pelosi last week to compromise with Trump. But she kept them unified and was able to beat Trump, even though he was vowing that this was going to go on for months or even years. And he certainly comes out politically weakened. I think that's one of the important takeaways of this whole episode.
So let's listen to Pelosi speaking about how it was that she was able to keep this caucus together and win the battle.
Pleased that we reached an agreement to reopen government now so that we can have a discussion on how to secure our borders. In our caucus, the beauty of it is the mix. And I always say, when people say to me, oh, you're so good at organizing your caucus, no, I don't unify our caucus. Our values unify us. And I'm sure it's the same in the Senate. And the fact is that our diversity is our strength, the differences of in so many different ways, including differences of opinion. That's our strength. But our unity is our power. And that is what maybe the president underestimated.
And that's Nancy Pelosi speaking on Friday as she signed a bill passed in the House that went on to be ratified by the Senate and the president to temporarily fund the government for 3 weeks. It sounded a little bit like politicians speak. Arun, one of the things that she said was that she talked about our values. Yet Democrats have been, some Democrats at least, been talking about offering up even $5.7 billion, the figure that Trump wants for his wall, saying that they're ready to spend that much on, quote, border security, just not a wall. And to me, that almost sounds like there isn't really that much difference then between values if this is just about saying no to a wall, because then you're just basically saying, we just don't want Trump to win.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the big problems here is, let's be honest, a democratic value is cowardice and surrender. So we wouldn't, I think, be in this mess if Pelosi and Schumer in September of 2017 hadn't struck a deal with Trump. You know, I know this seems like a few lifetimes ago, a year and a half ago in Trump era, in the Trump era timeline, but they struck a deal with Trump over the budget that had iced out the Republicans, in which they did not deal with the Dreamers. These are the young people who were have been bought over the border without documentation and have grown up here. This is the only country they've ever known. And they were given a provisional legal status under the Obama administration. Approximately 800,000 young people got this. And Trump had just rescinded it. He had had Jeff Sessions pull this provisional status, putting all 800,000 of these youth at risk for deportation. And there were members of the caucus, particularly of the Democratic caucus, particularly Latinos, who didn't want a budget deal unless something was done about the Dreamers. And Pelosi and Schumer did not agree to that because Trump dangled all sorts of money before them. And so this allowed him to continue using them as a bargaining chip. And in fact, we saw just the Saturday before Trump finally capitulated, he had floated this idea that if he got the $5.7 billion for a wall, that he would extend provisional status for 3 years for the Dreamers. And the Democrats rejected that even before he had his Rose Garden press conference. But the idea that it's their values is, of course, absurd. The only thing that the Democratic Party values is polling data.
Right. It seems as though one big lesson for Pelosi and the Democrats to come out of all of this ought to be, especially given the poll numbers, that when you grow a spine, when you stand firm to your values, your base actually likes that. I can't recall the number of times we've in the past thought, there they go again, caving in. The Republicans can stand firm and be united, and the Democrats just crumble. And felt like for once, the Democrats didn't crumble.
Yeah, you know, if we go back to the Obama era, let's not forget, after the Tea Party Republicans were elected in that just devastating wipeout in the 2010 midterms, Obama was all about debt reduction. This is during still when the economy was being savaged by the Great Recession, when you had a real unemployment rate that was above 16%, and he was promoting austerity. And he kept promoting that until essentially Occupy Wall Street came along and flipped the script from austerity to economic inequality. And this was basically the economic equivalent of medieval medicine. The idea when you have a downturn that you should cut government spending. And in a way, you know, we've also seen that we're still dealing with the repercussions of this, because I believe in something like over 30 states, school funding is still lower than it during the Great Recession. And that is what led to the teacher strike in Los Angeles, one of the factors. And that whole wave last year termed Red for Ed, where you had teachers in red states who were striking against this austerity. So the Democrats just constantly capitulate on everything. And I think if we're going to talk values, we forget that it's the right who is the one who really promotes values. Of course, they're really ugly, oppressive values. They're the values of racism. They're the values of misogyny. But we are possibly on the cusp of seeing Roe v. Wade, in terms of not overturned, at least gutted, even though two-thirds of the American public does not want an end to abortion. It is very much a position that is woefully in the minority. Or the fact that Trump keeps pushing the wall, even though there's a solid majority against it. And yet when the Democrats had a position that was really exciting their base, which was to abolish ICE, they ran away from it screaming like it was radioactive. And this has largely handed the immigration issue to Trump and the right. We should remember that the Democrats are not out there every day constantly advocating for immigrants, for refugees. If they care so much about values, they would be doing that.
Right. In fact, the Republicans were able to point to past statements made by many Democratic leaders saying that, look, you know, Hillary Clinton basically said the same thing that now Trump is saying, and many other examples. Now, so we have, you know, Nancy Pelosi looking good in the poll numbers for sticking firm and refusing to cave into Trump. But what role did workers themselves play? There were some major rallies, sit-ins. The leaders of federal employee unions had a sit-in in Mitch McConnell's office, were arrested. They had a silent protest. And then, of course, the leader of the flight attendants union came out and called for a general strike. And hours later, Trump sort of capitulated on the shutdown. What role did workers play?
Well, they played a huge role, clearly, and a lot of the credit should go to them. You know, this is really multiple factors at work here, as usually what happens with events of this historical magnitude. You know, Pelosi does deserve credit for keeping the caucus together. But what really ended it, and she acknowledged it in a tweet, was the flight controllers who were calling in sick to the point that air traffic was shutting down on the East Coast. LaGuardia incoming flights were being canceled en masse. Basically hours before Trump finally surrendered. Also, at one point, the IRS started calling back workers to process refunds, and they had called back 26,000 workers, and 14,000 of them did not show up. Then you also had the TSA agents, Transportation Security Agency. They were also calling in sick at a huge rate. So it was, I think, the workers who really forced Trump's hand in the end, because we got to remember that air traffic is not just about, you know, people going on vacation, that this is really the kind of the almost the muscles that holds an advanced economy together in the United States. It's all the air cargo. It's all the business travel. It has a huge impact. And if that starts to shut down, the economy would basically start to collapse almost overnight.
And Arun, it almost also seems as though the federal, the government shutdown highlighted the critical role that federal workers play in our society. I mean, we take them for granted, and then we realize our national parks run because of them, our tax refunds are processed because of them, our flight travel, air travel is safe because of them. And yet, this shutdown came on the heels of months of demonizing by the Republican Party of federal workers. In December, Trump announced a pay freeze for all federal workers right before this shutdown. And then he had the gall to retweet an article in the Daily Caller saying that the federal government shutdown was a great way to, you know, essentially work towards smaller government, how convenient it would be to end up with smaller government because of this shutdown. And he just retweeted that without comment. He came off, and his administration came off, looking incredibly unsympathetic to federal workers, and federal workers came across as being the essential workers that they are, right?
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that Trump could not have gotten away with any of this if he did not have this vast propaganda network that's behind him, like, you know, Fox News and all the digital media that's out there. This is, if he did not have the Republican Party behind them, of course, he has bent them to his will. And I've been talking about this with other journalists, where I think, like, Mitch McConnell was, no defense of McConnell, but he was not happy to be in the situation because he knew it was going to end badly. But, and most important, something like one third of the the American public is still behind him. Even as he was being like hammered in the media, his poll numbers are still around 35%, which is absolutely astonishing given what a disaster he is. And I think that the news media, it generally shows the poor job that they have been doing, that they still do not get Trump. They still do not understand how they should be historicizing what's going on much more in terms of the right of the rise of this authoritarian white nationalism, proto-fascism in the United States, and how this shutdown was the fulfillment of this fantasy that goes back decades. This is really a Reagan-era fantasy. Grover Norquist, who is this infamous right-wing firebrand, has said he wants, you know, the goal is to make government so small you can drown it in the bathtub. So Trump was fulfilling this right-wing fantasy of shutting down government, of showing that, oh, we really don't need all these agencies. We don't need the EPA, the Department of Education, of Labor, HUD, basically everything that has these vital tasks. You know, Native Americans suffered greatly because they, if those folks who live on the reservations are highly dependent on services from the federal government. You know, people who live in federally subsidized housing were threatened with eviction. There were millions of people on food stamps who were looking at possibly starting to starve in March if something wasn't done. And these are all things that the right wants to basically gut, and Trump was doing it for them.
I want to play first the clip that Wilbur Ross, of the Wilbur Ross interview on CNBC, where he basically showed his utter callousness, you know, sort of Aunt Marie Antoinette, like a let them eat cake moment. This is a man who wears $600 slippers, according to the New York Times. When asked whether he, you know, what federal workers were to do if the shutdown were to keep continuing, this is what Wilbur Ross had to say.
Well, first of all, the banks and the credit union should be making credit available to them. When you think about it, these are basically government-guaranteed loans because the government has committed these folks will get their back pay once this whole thing gets settled down. So there really is not a good excuse why there really should be a liquidity crisis. Now,
and that's Wilbur Ross saying there's no good excuse for there to be a liquidity crisis. That was his term for what government workers were going through. And then this is a Trump following up when asked about Wilbur Ross's comments. This is Trump talking about, well, buying groceries.
Mr. President, did you see Wilbur Ross said that he doesn't understand why federal workers would need help getting food? Can you understand?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard the statement, but I do understand that perhaps he should have said it differently. Local people know who they are when they go for groceries and everything else. And I think what Wilbur is probably trying to say is that they will work along. I know banks are working along. If you have mortgages, the mortgagees, the mortgage, the folks collecting the interest and all of those things, they work along. And that's what happens in time like this. They know the people, they've been dealing with them for years, and they work along. The grocery store, and I think that's probably what Wilbur Ross meant, but I haven't seen his statement, no. But he's done a great job, I will tell you that. Yes.
Venezuela, I just want to know, aren't you worried?
That is President Trump. I think he was attempting to make sense there, but it didn't quite come across, talking about banks will work along, grocery stores will work along. To any ordinary American, Arun, shouldn't this just have come across as the most out of touch, moneyed classes who literally probably have never bought their own groceries?
Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely absurd. You know, Donald Trump lives in this universe where everyone knows their corner grocer, and the Ku Klux Klan are upstanding citizens protecting white women from the dark hordes, like his father apparently was. So the grocery industry, of course, there's basically about four corporations that control the entire grocery industry in the United States. There is no grocery store that's going to be like, yeah, sure, you know, Joe and Jane will give you a $200 credit. Just pay us when you can. This is something that, from some, like, you know, 1930s Hollywood fantasy that he's living in. And I think, you know, there's always this question, like, oh, if they weren't so out of touch, you know, maybe this wouldn't have blown up in their face so badly. You know, we saw much of this with the Bush administration. But this really, I think it's important to remember, completely crosses the ruling class in this country. You know, Tim Geithner, when he was Obama's Treasury Secretary, he said of millions of fraudulent foreclosures that happened under Obama, that that was foaming the runway for the banks, that they encouraged those foreclosures, throwing millions of families out of their home, including fraudulently, to help the banks. Or Alan Greenspan's famous quote when he talked about how that reality essentially did not comport with the Federal Reserve's economic models. The problem wasn't their models, the problem was reality. But this is really infects the complete economic discipline in what's known as neoclassical economics in this country, where they think that humans are inconvenient and irrelevant to economic calculations. So as much as we're outraged by Trump and Ross and that crowd, we have to remember that this is the rule across the entire ruling class, liberal to conservative.
Isn't this an important political moment for grassroots activism? Then you have this exposing of their claims that federal workers are not necessary. You have it, you know, you have a moment where sympathy for workers is extremely high, a political loss for Trump, and Pelosi, you know, in a place where she has some leverage, if only she could be pushed, and she certainly could be pushed by progressives to do the right thing. What sort of openings are there for progressives, grassroots pressure right now? What would you like to see happen?
Well, let's talk about the labor issue. Now, to put this in context, the federal employees' unions, there are about 850,000 workers who are in unions. The main one is the American Federation of Government Employees that has 700,000 members. It is illegal under federal law for them, this strike that was outlawed by Taft-Hartley and other ordinances since.
And I think people didn't realize that, because there were these sort of blithe calls for federal workers to go on strike, but you're right, it is illegal for them to go on strike.
And not just illegal, they can be jailed. They, you know, if they go on strike, there was a 1966 law in that it was illegal for them to even know about any concerted strike action. And that was struck down by the Supreme Court in 1971, which did uphold a lower court ruling that said there is no constitutional right to strike for federal government employees. Now, this can, of course, Congress can change. And it's always about, like, oh, national safety, national security. But we're left with the absurd contradiction that where air traffic controllers cannot strike, airline pilots can strike. And that would be much more devastating to the economy than if the air traffic controllers, or if, say, the transportation, the TSA workers, if they walked out.
And also, so I mean, if you're not going to outlaw shutdowns and you're not going to let them strike, then essentially when the government does shut down, you put air traffic safety into even greater risk than allowing them to strike.
Yeah. And, you know, early on, Trump said, like, oh, this is like a strike. And it's just like, no, this is completely that's completely backwards. This is what's called a lockout, you know, where. Yeah. And this happens regularly, where corporations lock out workers and don't let them come to their jobs. And that's what Trump was doing. Now, also under federal law, the Federal Labor Management Act of 1978, federal employees cannot bargain over all sorts of issues in terms of wages, benefits, workplace conditions. So these unions are really hamstrung in all sorts of ways. And Congress could easily lift these restrictions. And this is, may turn out to be a really historic moment because it's a bookend to what happened with the Reagan administration in 1981, where we should remember that that was when PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, went on strike, and it was an illegal strike. But there had been two decades of illegal strikes. There had been something like 39 strikes by federal employees going back to the early 1960s. And so this is about social power, we have to remember. And I think that's what Trump is a very good reminder. I mean, the guy's basically like the biggest mafia don who's ever existed, but he gets away with it because he has all this social power. The law is very malleable. So when you had these period in the 60s and 70s of this mass unionization of public workers, you know, the first wave of unionization going back to the 1930s is a private sector workers. Then you start to see, and then the peak is hit in unionization in the early 1950s, and it starts to decline there. But then you have this wave of mass unionization of public sector workers at the local, state, and federal level. And federal employees were regularly going on strike, and PATCO had previously gone on strike in, it was, I think, late 60s or early 1970s. And then in 1981, they said they were going to go on strike again, even though they were still under a court order from that previous strike a decade earlier not to go on strike. And Reagan fired them all. And that really ushered in, that really broke the back, let's be honest, of organized labor in this country as a powerful social force. And it has never really recovered from that. We've started to finally see these glimmers of hope, you know, beginning with the teacher strike, which was a launched by the Chicago Teachers Union in 2012, and who they've kind of defined this new wave of social justice unionism. Because even for unions that are allowed to strike under federal labor law, you're only allowed to strike over such things as wages, benefits, and workplace conditions. But what teachers have successfully done is very much tie the workplace conditions to the well-being of students. So they strike over such things as not having enough support staff, not having enough nurses, and all that. So I think changing federal law to give the employees more rights would be a big step.
Well, Arun, I want to thank you so much for joining us, as always. We might have to have you back on in 3 weeks if there is yet another shutdown. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, Raw Story, and The Intercept. His forthcoming book is called Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's a regular news correspondent for our program. We've been discussing lessons from the battle over the government shutdown. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.